first speaker this evening is well qualified to address us on the subject of the Synod's Constitution and Bylaws after having served 29 years in the parish ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. For the last 12 years, he has served both as secretary of our church body and secretary of the very important committee, which is Synod's Commission on Constitutional Matters. So we're happy this evening, Dr. Herbert Miller, to welcome you to our midst.
Well, thank you, Professor Schmidt, and I certainly want to express my appreciation to all of you who have come out in the face of this threatening storm. I thought I might be talking to possibly four or five people this evening, because every once in a while I get the feeling, in this day and age, who cares about the Synod's Constitution anymore? Even some folks who a few years back placed a good deal of emphasis on the Constitution seem to have gotten into the way of thinking that, well, perhaps there are other ways of doing this thing a little better. I think that at the very beginning we ought to remind ourselves that when we speak of the Constitution of our Synod, we are not being legalistic. You have heard that expression, I think, so often that perhaps you have become immune to it and perhaps have even accepted it as being a fact. The Constitution is, of course, in a certain sense, from a certain standpoint, a set of laws. However, the Constitution of our Synod should not really be looked upon as laws, but rather as a covenant, which we have entered into with one another in order to carry on this work jointly that we, the congregations forming the Synod, have decided to undertake. This is very important to remember. It's a joining of hands that we have. It's an agreement to walk together. It's not something from oben herab, but it's not something vertical, in other words, the structure of the Synod, but it is more of a horizontal nature. In our Constitution and the accompanying bylaws, we decide jointly, together, of our own free will, what we are going to do as a Synod, how we are going to do it, and who is going to do it. Now, this is rather unique among constitutions and among frameworks of government, generally speaking. We find, for instance, and I'm mentioning this because I'm well aware of the fact that I'm speaking particularly to laymen tonight, that lay people sometimes have difficulty in understanding our concept of government or the polity of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. You folks live day by day in a workaday world. We may even say that you are influenced from day to day at the place where you work through the corporate philosophy which underlies so much of American life. In the corporate philosophy of government, you have a structured vertical relationship, up and down. You've got bosses where you work, unless you happen to be a homemaker or have a business all by yourself without people under you or over you. You are in that type of a relationship where you have a boss over you and perhaps you in turn are bossing other people. When we stop to think of it, our American life is quite militaristic or Prussian. We're used to this kind of thing. I sometimes like to refer to this as the centurion philosophy of administration. You know, remember the centurion of Capernaum, who said, "I say to one servant, go and he goeth, and to another, come and he cometh." Well, that's not the kind of thing that we have in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. It's more of a family arrangement. It's more of a partnership arrangement. We join hands and we willingly work together. You do this, you do that, you do that. And we'll get along real well together. So it's not bossism that we have under our constitutional form of government in the Missouri Synod, but rather a joining of hands in a partnership relationship. Now that sometimes is hard for, as I said before, for lay people to understand, especially when they come into the structure of the Synod, when they are elected to a board or a commission, or when they become staff members of the Synod. They are so used to this vertical relationship that they think that that's the way the Synod operates too. We encounter that so often. Also, when people are elected, when they're freshly, newly elected to the board of directors of the Synod. Now, there the problem is compounded, because the Board of Directors of the Synod is not at all tantamount to the Board of Directors in an ordinary corporation. Our Synod has lived under its Constitution for about 130 years already, and the Constitution has had very little change during that time, which indicates already how well it was thought out and how well it was constructed. Now, there are, of course, many different ideas along this line, ways of improving it, and we have always been open to these ways. And about 50 years ago, mind you, about 75 or 80 years after the Synod was organized, it was felt that there needed to be what we might call a super board of control. Our colleges and seminaries each had a board of control, and each of them would be out soliciting funds for the operation of the school, and that in the course of time created some difficulties. And it was felt that there ought to be a kind of super board of control which would coordinate all of this. And so that kind of an organization or a board was called into being. Well, what shall we call that board? By that time, some of our folks had become Americanized. You know, our background is largely German. And they had gotten into this corporation idea, so they picked up the expression of board of directors. This is how that coordinating board in the Synod got its name, board of directors. A more precise and exact name for it would really be something like a finance board, or a department of the budget, or some such thing. To this day, that is still their primary function, budgeting, finance, coordinating the finances of the Synod, and seeing to that the budget is actually observed and carried out. In the course of time, some additional duties were assigned to the Board of Directors in the field of personnel and being the legal representative of the Synod. At one time, we did not even bother to be incorporated, but once we were incorporated, the Board of Directors, of course, under the laws of the state, were the responsible body for the corporation. So when lay people now are elected to the Board of Directors, they come out of a corporate background, they hear the word Board of Directors, and they have an idea that, well, this is something like the Board of Directors of General Motors, of AT&T, or some such thing, and it isn't that at all. And sometimes it's very difficult for them to adjust themselves to the situation. And what is the situation? Well, the situation is this. Since the Synod grew in the course of time, not only in numbers, but also in what it was able and wanted to do jointly, you had this situation developing when a convention of the Synod would decide, well, maybe we ought to do this kind of work. Maybe we ought to serve blind people, for instance. All right? So the way to do it was elect a board for missions to the blind. And then that board did the work. And it was only within recent times that the Synod said to some of our boards, well, now, it's true your work has multiplied considerably, and we will allow you to engage a full-time person to help you do this. That was the beginning of staff. And then in the course of time, maybe the work grew, and a second man was engaged, a third man. And some of our boards now have whole departments of staff. But that's the way it went. The Synod would always create a new board and say, well, now, you do that work. So that at the present time, we have some 39 boards and commissions of various kinds in existence in the Synod. And that, of course, brings up the problem, well, maybe we have too many. Maybe we ought to put some of them together. A few years back, we took several of these boards and made a larger board for missions out of these four or five smaller boards. Some of you may remember that. Some of you may have been involved in that process. That's fine. But there is also a limit to what you can do along that line, because the work of our Synod has become so widespread and many-faceted that it is really physically impossible for one group of men and women to be competent enough to act in a responsible way, exercising judgment over that whole area of work that is carried on in the Synod. And so the fundamental idea that prevailed when the Synod was organized, namely a horizontal relationship, not a structured relationship up and down, continues to have merit to this day. And we still operate with this partnership principle. And behind that partnership principle among the boards and commissions of the Synod is also the partnership principle of the membership of the Synod itself. The congregations form the basic membership of the Synod. The congregations have the franchise, the vote. Each congregation on a district level for a district convention is entitled to two votes. It's the congregation's pastoral vote and the congregation's lay vote that is being cast at a district convention. And a similar thing prevails for the synodical conventions. And to this day, we stress this unique character of the synod, namely that the congregations, to a large extent, remain self-governing. They are in partnership with one another through the synod. The officers that are elected by the congregations, the officers in the synod, are not the bosses in the synod, they are the servants of the synod. The boards and commissions are not the bosses, they are the servants of the synod. The synod tells them what the boards and commissions should do, and the staff people in turn render service to the respective boards that are involved. We have a high degree of autonomy on the part of the congregations in our synod. It is not a complete autonomy. It cannot be. Nobody really has complete autonomy, complete government over his own actions. As soon as even two Christian people enter into a relationship with each other, there has to be a set of agreements, and there has to be a giving up of an unrestricted sense of rights and privileges, even in marriage. You give up certain of your independence when you become married, and you also make certain agreements with your husband or with your wife. That's about the way it is in the synod. Congregations still remain more or less self-governing, and yet they do, for the sake of their own welfare and for the sake of the common good of the whole body, agree that they will yield certain privileges. Well, what are they? The main one is a devotion to the doctrinal standard of the synod. A congregation which wants to be a member of the synod and remain a member of the synod must accept the doctrinal standard of the synod. We accept the Bible as the inspired word of God, and we accept the Lutheran confessions as a true exposition of what that word of God teaches. And if a congregation is not willing to subscribe to that, it can no longer be a member of the synod. Die reine Lehre, some of you know German. Die reine Lehre, the pure doctrine, this was at the heart of the organization of the synod. And no one to this day really understands the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod unless he understands that at the heart of our life together is this continuing concern for the pure doctrine of God's word. Both the law of God, which condemns us of our sin and shows us our need of a Savior, and then above all, the gospel, which brings us that Savior, our Lord Jesus Christ. So that's the first thing. This is sometimes called the glue that holds the synod together. Another point, and it's right in line with that, is the agreement of the congregations that they are going to train their own pastors for their pulpits because they are concerned about the reine Lehre. We need to remember that when the synod was organized, there were colleges and seminaries in this country that were training Lutheran pastors. So somebody might say, there was really no need for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod to introduce its own system of training pastors. But the synod said, we want to train our own pastors. And to this day, it has been very insistent about that, upon the procedures for certification, so that a pastor who is accepted in one area of our synod should be accepted in another area of our synod, without question. This is one of the fundamental things. A congregation agrees, as a member of the synod, we will have as our pastor a man who has been trained and accredited and certified according to the rules and regulations, if you want to call them that, that we have agreed to together, free, willingly, of our own volition. No compulsion there. Congregations say, this is the way we want it. We want to be protected. I'm always reminded at this point of a congregation near the place where I grew up, which was older than the synod and did not join the synod for quite some time after the synod was organized. But one thing that really pushed them in the direction of joining the synod finally was the fact that for a couple of years it was served by a man who posed as a Lutheran preacher but was in reality a Jewish rabbi. And the congregation said, no more of this. Well, and then, of course, you see, these two hang together, the concern for the pure doctrine and then the joint training and certification of pastors to see to that the pure doctrine is maintained. Then we have also many other things that we want to do together. And instead of maintaining upon our own right as a congregation to do it one certain way, we say, well, let's do it the way we agreed to do it together. So that, for instance, we have an order of service which is more or less identical with certain allowances. These rubrics, you know, some are may and some are shall, so that congregations do have some leeway, but in general, you walk into Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod Church on a Sunday morning, and you have a pretty good idea about how the service is going to go. And you don't feel as though you're a spectator who needs a scorecard because you don't know who's on first and what's going to happen next. Now, I have distributed this evening for you this copy of the Constitution of the Synod. I would like to ask, how many of you have ever before seen a copy of the Constitution of the Synod? Would you please raise your hand? All right. Well, I think that you are more aware of this than the average group would be, because we usually find that even good, faithful members of congregations belonging to the Synod and are willing to abide by the doctrinal position of the Synod and everything else have never really looked at the Constitution of the Synod and never even seen a copy of it. So you can take this home. I'm sure you don't have a copy in your possession, unless you happen to have a copy of the Synodical Handbook. Now, you see, the Constitution is very short. We got it on four sides, two sheets. This is the Synodical Handbook, considerably larger. But the Synodical Handbook has in it also two other documents, the Articles of Incorporation, and that's a very short document, and the Bylaws of the Synod, which cover most of the territory in this particular book. The bylaws are much larger than the Constitution. Now, people have sometimes said, in our day and age especially, that maybe we need to rework our Constitution. They think that there are imperfections there. I have put it in the form of a question. Imperfections? Well, yes, we can find imperfections. I'm thinking, for instance, of language imperfections. I have given as one example there Article 6, if you can find it on your sheet. Conditions for acquiring and holding membership in the Synod are, now look at point 2, renunciation of unionism and syncretism of every description. Now, maybe this could be clarified. Do all of you understand what syncretism is? It's a big word that's hardly ever used nowadays anymore. So in that sense, maybe the Constitution could be clarified. The language could be made simpler and more modern. I'm not talking about the content now. I'm talking about language. Now, as far as content is concerned and language also, I have also given there Article 3 as another example. I think that perhaps point 6, if you can find that, needs some, not really clarification, but enlargement. Talking about the objects of the Synod, what we intend to do together, the furtherance of Christian parochial schools and of a thorough instruction for confirmation. Now, that's the language of 130 years ago, and that was the main thinking in regard to Christian education in those days. Now, we have grown in our understanding of Christian education since that time. We include more than simply parochial schools and confirmation instruction. We may still think of them as being, you know, at the heart of it. But what about our Sunday schools, our vacation Bible schools, our weekday schools, our part-time, release-time educational programs? What about our youth Bible study groups? What about our adult Bible study programs? I think we have to admit that way, way back, 100 years ago or so, it was usually felt that, well, as long as you had your confirmation instruction, that's about all the formal Christian instruction that was needed. Maybe some of the parents in some congregations also had the benefit of sitting in at least and listening to what was in those days called Christenlehre. How many of you had the experience of Christenlehre years ago? Aha! Okay, there are not many left anymore. I still remember it. When I was young, moving to a very German community, Addison, Illinois, where Pastor Fotenhauer was the pastor, and I think it was every Wednesday afternoon from 3 until 3:45, all the school children went up in the auditorium, and Pastor Fodenhauer conducted Christenlehre, and quite a few of the parents sat in the back and listened to see how well their kids were doing. And once in a while, they got involved too. While Article 7 we have mentioned here, much attention has been given to that. That is an article which on the one hand is very important because it underlines the sovereignty, let's say, of the congregation. And it does not give this up when it belongs to the synod. On the other hand, however, there's also another side to it, and that is that that sovereignty is sometimes abused. Now, congregations, as is indicated before, when they join the synod, do agree to walk together with the other congregations in the synod, unless it can be demonstrated that what the synod has decided is contrary to the word of God or is not expedient as far as that particular congregation is concerned. By the way, that's interesting. I don't know whether Dr. Silflo got into this in his lecture, that inexpedient word. In the old German constitution, the word that was used there was the word ungeeignet, and it was translated with the word inexpedient. Now, you who are German sharks know that that's a bad translation. Here again, I guess the folks in those days didn't know the English language too well, and they looked it up in the dictionary, and that was a nice, high-sounding word, I suppose, inexpedient. Ungeeignet means it doesn't fit the situation. A good example, if the Synod should pass a resolution regarding certain textbooks that were to be used in parochial schools, and here there was a congregation that did not have a parochial school, then that resolution was inexpedient for it, ungeeignet. It just didn't fit the situation, you see. That was really the meaning of it originally. But we have to live with it now, because even though it's a faulty translation, it was adopted by the Synod in its new constitution. So it is now part of our constitution. So there have been people who have said that maybe Article 7 ought to be cleared up too. All right, now I have here under B, that's a misprint there. It should not be policy, but polity, P-O-L-I-T-Y. Polity is a sort of a technical word meaning form of government. Now, having lived quite intimately with the Constitution over many years, especially the last 20 years or so, I have really, and this is of course only one man's opinion, I must admit this, I have really grown year by year in my appreciation of what we have in the Constitution. And I am less and less inclined to think that we need a new form of government in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I think we have something absolutely unique. As I mentioned the other day to Professor Schmidt, we usually think of Dr. Walther primarily as the great theologian of our synod. And this is true. But he was also the principal architect of our synodical polity, constitution, and the original bylaws. And I have learned to appreciate him also as a genius in the field of political science, if you may. He is a political scientist, I think, of the highest order. The mere fact that our Synod's constitution has survived for 130 years with only really minor changes indicates how well this man planned, what a good architect he was of the government, the type of government that we have within our Synod. Now, we should always be open to doing things in a better way. But I think that we ought to be on our guard that we don't jump for something new just because it's new. What's the old saying? Be not the last by whom the new is tried, nor the first to lay the old aside. Maybe we need to remember that in this connection too. Simply because the Constitution is old and has maybe some archaic language in it, which could be quite readily cleaned up, doesn't mean that we necessarily have to move into an entirely new type of structure. Now, there are people who are suggesting a new type of structure, and that's why I said before, this is my personal opinion, I don't want to impose it on you, and there are especially two trends among people who want a new type of structure in our synod. The one trend I have already indicated to you, and that is that there is a feeling that we ought to assume more and more the corporate model, where we have a board of directors which is really a board of directors which makes all decisions between conventions and avoids a lot of perhaps misunderstanding and duplication and so forth that some people sometimes seem to find in the work of the Synod. And I don't have to talk about that. The other trend is the trend toward what might be called federalism. The tendency, and this has been a kind of a growing thing, it's been going on more and more as time has gone on, a tendency to have the districts of the Synod become more or less little synods of their own, so that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod finally becomes merely a federation of self-governing districts, which one might just as well call synods then. Now, that's the type of polity, for instance, that you find in the Lutheran Church in America. But we have a different history. Our church body did not come into existence by several church bodies amalgamating and forming the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. That was the case with the Lutheran Church in America, and also the case with the American Lutheran Church. Our church came into being in another way. There was a certain number of congregations, very small in number to begin with. They formed the synod. And then these congregations grew in number. And then finally they got so big, still small by our standards, but they got so big that they decided maybe we ought to divide ourselves into districts for certain purposes. And so the synod created four districts. They are the creation of the synod. Districts are also, like boards and commissions, the servants of the congregations. And they are specifically in a relationship to the synod so that even though the synod over against the congregation is primarily of an advisory nature, the synod over against the districts is not at all advisory. The district is a subdivision of the synod, like a wholly owned subsidiary of a corporation. That's what districts are. But there has been the tendency, going like Topsy, for districts to become more and more independent, self-governing, or what have you. And there are some people who, perhaps even though they may not like it, say, well, you can hardly fight it anymore. You might as well let it be that way. And completely change our polity so that we become a federation of self-governing districts. Well, as I indicated to you, I think that what we have is pretty good. Now, when it comes to the adequacy of the bylaws, that's a different thing. I have often said that bylaws ought to be a living, breathing thing. If bylaws are not changed constantly, then I think something's wrong with the organization. It's asleep. So you see, the Constitution ought to be a basic covenant which stands there and which does not change very easily. But bylaws ought to be very adaptable. When we have new opportunities or new problems, new situations, these ought to be met with revisions in the bylaws. Now, the reasons for the change ought to be valid again. They ought to be to enable us better to serve our Lord Jesus Christ and the people for whom he shed his precious blood. Now, I have to move along. Point three, proposed changes. These are proposed changes which are being talked about, and some of them, most of them, in fact, in this list that I just arbitrarily set up for you to give you some examples, most of them are, in fact, before the Dallas Convention for action of one kind or another. I have already talked about B, the power of the Board of Directors. There are some who feel, frankly, that that power of the Board of Directors should be increased to make it, in their estimation, more efficient. They're, of course, thinking in these vertical terms rather than in the partnership terms. I always come back to this statement of the Scripture, for instance, and I think it's very applicable to our life together in the Synod. One is your master, even Christ, and we are all servants one of another. All right, then there are, to go back to A now, there are also some people who feel that maybe the power of the president needs to be increased. When you read the Constitution first, you will notice that a great deal of authority is given to the synodical president. But when you look at it a second time and begin asking, well, can this be done or can that be done, you suddenly discover that there are built-in checks and balances, which again is a good thing, because we want no papacy in the Lutheran Church, least of all in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. So there's a sort of a tension. there are some elements of the bishopric, but they are very, very muted. And that is why we have never suggested or never encouraged for a moment the use of the word bishop under our Missouri Synod polity. The synodical president is not a bishop, and our district presidents are not bishops. Unless, of course, you want to really put into that word bishop all sorts of meanings that it ordinarily is not taken to have. So, it's a different kind of a position entirely. Then C, we have had for quite a number of years now an ongoing discussion about the frequency of conventions. It was interesting, about 15 years ago, the boards and commissions, and specifically the people working for the boards and commissions, the staff people, thought that the triennial conventions were not frequent enough. And they sort of pushed for a change to have a convention not every third year, but every second year, biennial conventions. Now, of course, time has gone on, and there are new staff people on the scene, and they are hurting under this, and understandably so. I hope that even though perhaps the Synod may not be ready to make a change as yet, I hope at least that there will be a degree of understanding there, that after all, you have a convention in July, and you know what it's like the rest of the summer. People are off on their vacations. It's hard to have the boards of the Synod get together while they finally get together in September or October, and they begin planning the new year, and it maybe takes until January or March or April before the thing is really underway. And then by the time next September or October comes around, they are already under the gun and under the compulsion to begin formulating their report and their recommendations to the next convention. And it really doesn't give enough time. So from the standpoint of the people who do the work for the congregations of the Synod, maybe it would be better if we would have a convention not every other year, but every third year or every fourth year. Now, there are all sorts of ideas about that. It is suggested, for instance, well, maybe we could have a legislative convention, and the main purpose of our conventions is legislative, to set the directions for the Synod for the next biennium or triennium or whatever it happens to be. There are some who say, well, let's have a legislative convention 1 year, and then 2 years later, let's have an inspirational gathering. And then 2 years later, have a legislative convention again. An inspirational gathering on the order of our youth gatherings that we've had, you know, in New Orleans and different places, or on the order of, maybe some of you won't appreciate the examples I'm using, on the order of the Jehovah's Witnesses gatherings when they gather in Yankee Stadium or some big ballpark for a weekend of revivalism and so forth. Well, this could have some merit. D, the representation formulas. I said before that every congregation has the vote, two votes really. Now, on the synodical level, a group of congregations form a circuit, and at a circuit meeting where there are two representatives from each congregation, a pastor and a layperson, both of them chosen by the congregation, these representatives now choose a pastor and a layman to represent the congregations of that circuit at the convention of the Synod. That's the way we're structured, and that's time-honored. This is the way it was from the very beginning. Dr. Walther and his fellow workers wanted to have a balance there between clergy and lay. They did not want to have the church dominated by clergy, and on the other hand, it was recognized that clergy does play a shepherding role in the church, so the pastoral function should be recognized. And this is how they solved that, what might otherwise be attention. Now there are some people who think that, well, maybe we ought to go to a different type of representation. Perhaps it ought to be on the basis of the size of the congregation. Maybe there ought to be one lay delegate for every 500 communicant members at a district convention, so that a congregation with 2,000 communicant members would have one pastoral delegate and four lay delegates. That, of course, would destroy this balance that I've just referred to. But people will say, well, is it important to continue to maintain that balance? Others, again, think that voting rights should not be tied in with the congregations, necessarily, or restricted to the congregations. They should have the vote, but they say that the voting rights should also be given to all professional workers who are on the rosters of the church body. So pastors who are serving campus, in campus ministries where there is no organized congregation that is a member of the Synod, they would have a vote. Parochial school teachers would have a vote. That, by the way, is a perennial question that has come up again and again at conventions, that the teachers ought to be given a vote, but it has always been turned down, not because the conventions don't like teachers, but because nobody could really find a good solution to that question of how could they be given voting rights without destroying our historical concepts of the franchise. But maybe someday this will happen. E, adjudication and appeal. That covers one whole chapter in the bylaws, and I'm sure you're not too acquainted with that, but it is a problem to those who have to administer this. This is the procedure when there are difficulties. May I, for instance, refer to a well-known example occurring right here on this campus? What happens in a case like that? How is it dealt with? What are the rights of the people who are affected? And how are their rights guaranteed? And how are they to be implemented? And so forth. This is a whole chapter in the bylaws governing this. And it's a very difficult chapter because cases vary so, one from the next. And it's almost impossible to write out proper procedures to cover every conceivable kind of case. And every once in a while, we find ourselves confronted with a case that we just have to scratch our heads and say, well, we don't know exactly what ought to be done in this particular instance because of certain facts or facets of the situation. F, I referred to before, training and certification. There are proposals. Again, we're thinking of what happened on this campus, the problem of Seminex. There are quite a few proposals before the convention regarding the certification of Seminex graduates. How can they be certified? Other overtures, again, ask that they not be certified in any special way, but that they ought to follow the regular procedures that we have set forth. In fact, the Synod even went out of its way at the last convention to liberalize the procedure for their sake. G, nomination and election of president. We have just passed through that experience now for the second time. A new type of nominating procedure. Formerly, the nomination for president and first vice president was made on the floor of the convention. Every voting delegate wrote in a name. And that was like a primary write-in ballot. And then just 6 years ago, the Synod adopted a new procedure. They thought it would be better to permit all congregations, if they wanted to nominate someone for those two positions, president and first vice president. Now, I'm sure your congregation, if it did not participate in it, at least you received the ballots and you knew that you had the chance to participate if you wanted to. And you are aware of the fact that only about 2 weeks ago, we were finally able to announce who the five candidates were on each ballot, because this time, unlike 4 years ago when this system was tried the first time, I, who had the responsibility of notification and all that, encountered the problem of having a lot of people turning me down. They said, no, I don't want my name on the ballot, for one reason or another. Partly because some of the men felt that people who were nominated should not be obligated to promise in advance that they would serve in that position if they were elected. Now, that particular thing especially will be looked at, I think, very closely at the Dallas Convention. It was proposed to change that already 4 years ago, but the convention finally decided, well, we have tried this new system only once, let's try it again before we make any changes in it. But I think that the second time around has shown that this is even a greater problem. And I personally feel that we should not expect more of these men than a willingness to have their name on the ballot. And then if that person should be elected some 4 or 5 months later, then he ought to have at least a reasonable time, 24 hours or 48 hours, to decide whether or not to accept it. I think a lot would depend, for instance, what happened at the time of the election? Was there a lot of bad blood Were there a lot of charges of politicking or vote buying or something like that? Then if I were in that position, I might say, I don't want it. Let the church choose somebody else and be at peace, instead of being fussing about whether or not my candidacy was proper. I'm, of course, using myself simply as an example here. Or there may have been some very major changes in the world itself, in the life of the church, or even in the life of that individual who was nominated. Perhaps in March he was willing, but in July perhaps he has a wife who has discovered that she has terminal cancer and has maybe 2 or 3 months to live. And he feels maybe this is where I ought to be devoting the next 2 or 3 months instead of at an office, at a synodical headquarters. So that's one of the things that will be looked at. It may be that the Synod will decide to keep it as it is. Then the problem of dual membership, you of course are acquainted with that. That refers especially to this problem of the AELC. Now the Commission on Constitutional Matters has ruled very firmly, without any question of any doubt, even after we were asked to look at it again, that dual membership simply is, here I'll use a German word again, an Unding, something that just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And it might be of interest to you to know that the other Lutheran church bodies in the Lutheran Council in the United States of America felt the same way when it dealt with the application of the AELC to be accepted as a participating body in the council. The reason why that was postponed, any action on that application was postponed, was because the other two church bodies, and I found no one who disagreed with this among the representatives of the other two church bodies, also said, this just don't go. You don't belong to two different church bodies at one and the same time and be under two different ecclesiastical jurisdictions and so forth. So this has to be cleared up. But of course it's a question of when. I suppose most of you are aware of it, that the commission then, after it was pointed out to them that our Concordia plans did not have provisions for reinstatement or for a period, let's see, what do you call it, any insurance men in the audience, where you have an extension of time, an automatic extension of time. Pardon? Yeah, that's it, a grace period. They had nothing like that in the bylaws of our Concordia plans. So that, for instance, here was a parochial school teacher who was loyal to the Synod. He was serving, however, in a congregation that had decided to join the AELC. He would be cut off from all of his pension benefits and was out of consideration for people caught in the middle. And because there were not proper provisions to take care of such instances, that the commission finally decided, well, let's set the implementation date into the future so that that can be taken care of, and incidentally, now also a convention of the Synod can speak its mind on the subject too. It could say, well, we'll implement it right now, first day of the convention, or they'll say we'll stay with the September 1 date, or they may say let's extend it for another year, or they may say in regard to certain sections of the Synod, we will extend the date. The overseas problem, for instance. There are the missionaries overseas. How do you get to them to explain all this to them? All of these things, I'm sure, will be taken into consideration, and the Synod will need the wisdom of a Solomon, I think, to come up with the right answer to that. The final one that I've listed here is the status of doctrinal statements. That has troubled us for quite some time. The Commission on Constitutional Matters recommended that a special committee should be appointed to develop a bylaw which would set forth very clearly the status of doctrinal statements, how they were to be adopted, and how they were to be amended or repealed if that became necessary. That recommendation of the CCM was endorsed by the Board of Directors, by the CTCR, and by the Committee for Reorganization, which has now been superseded by the Task Force on Constitution, Bylaws, and Structure. So that committee was called into being, and they have a proposed set of bylaws to offer to the Synod to try to set to answer this question. It still is a difficult thing. It maybe does not really come to grips completely with the problem. I have to say that because I was a member of the committee, but at least we hope that it will be a step in the right direction toward clarifying the whole status of doctrinal statements, and to distinguish them from so-called doctrinal resolutions. We're saying that there should be a difference between the two, also as to how they are called into being. All right, now I have already referred to the corrective of checks and balances. Sometimes when people complain, they look at the handbook and they say, on one page it says this and another page it says that. Now, isn't that a contradiction? Isn't there an overlap here and so forth? Sometimes we say, oh, no, it isn't, because you're misreading it. But sometimes we would have to say, well, maybe there is a little bit of an overlap. And we sometimes find that that might be a good thing, because it sometimes helps to keep people a little honest and a little bit on their toes. If two different groups are more or less in a related area, maybe there's some good healthy competition going on as to who's going to do the better job. For instance, of developing Bible study materials. The Board of Parish Education has the primary responsibility for that, but the Board of Youth Ministry is in that particular work, developing Bible studies for young people. The Board of Evangelism likes to develop Bible studies in its particular field, and fine, that's all right, because each of them has a certain type of expertise that it can bring to that particular type of Bible study that it wants to develop. Okay, now, I think that we have a few minutes if there are any questions. I suppose that's the way we proceed. All right. Yes?
Dr. Miller, I deeply appreciate your comments on the Constitution and bylaws of the Missouri Synod. And I can spend the rest of the evening asking some questions, but I have one. Just what are the duties of the district presidents? To me, they have far exceeded the duties outlined in our bylaws. But I have one in particular. I know that they are to supervise doctrine within their district. In my opinion, many of them are not qualified to do that at this time. They're asking and inviting congregations to leave the Missouri Synod, which I think is beyond their duty. Now, in my opinion, we should invent a new committee, a new group, to take the place of the council of presidents and dissolve that group completely. And I'd like to hear you speak about what are the duties of the district.
Well, if you'll look at page 22 here, this is the best, I think, that we can do here. We could spend a lot of time because their duties are quite extensive. But point 7, 8, 9, and, those are the three paragraphs there particularly. You have already pointed out their primary responsibility, the supervision of doctrine within their particular area as a servant of the Synod, however. And then there is also the very important point, which is, of course, much discussed in our day and age, that they are to see to it that the resolutions of the Synod are carried out. This is where we've had some problems in recent years. This gets into this area of, are districts really autonomous or aren't they? They are not. They are the creation of the Synod. And if a district president feels that he cannot, in good conscience, carry out the resolutions of the Synod, I think the honorable course for him to follow is plain. Now, there are, of course, some additional functions. He is to see to it that congregations are visited regularly by circuit counselors and the like. He is to advise congregations in the calling of pastors and teachers. I know the problem that you're pointing to, and it's a very real one. I think that I should like to mention this in connection with it, and you may want to think about this. There is one proposal before the Synod, which I think is of some tantalizing importance. It comes from a small congregation up in Wisconsin, and they are suggesting that district presidents ought to be elected more or less in the same way in which circuit counselors are elected. You know how that would be done? It would be like this, that the districts would nominate the man that they want as district president, but then the Synod would have the final word on it in convention. The Synod then could accept that slate, or it could nominate somebody else and elect somebody else. That's about the way the election of circuit counselors takes place now. This congregation uses the argument that would really make and remind us once again of the fact that district presidents are, first of all, officers of the Synod, and only secondly, officers of the district. Their primary responsibility lies toward the Synod. Incidentally, a little point. That is why, for the conventions of the Synod, it's the Synod that pays the tab for the district presidents, not the districts. Okay.
The district president does not have authority to certify a
That is correct. He does not have that authority.
So they're exercising that, and I think some discipline should be exercised on those individuals.
They are permitting congregations to call these people, and the ordinations have been permitted over the past few years. I think we can say that the situation is better today than it was a few years ago. There are proposals, as I said before, about changing the methods of certifying candidates. All right, somebody else? Yes?
What is the information on the information that we call the dual membership in the ADLC and Missouri Senate? And why is Troy's position lately, he's for extending this beyond September 1 and maybe let it go out in 2 or 3 years?
Yes, I think so. Number one, first of all, the Commission on Constitutional Matters has, on two different occasions, set forth its position, and that is that it is not possible, that it is improper, unconstitutional, to hold membership in another church body in addition to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Now, as far as Dr. Preuss's position on this is concerned, he has stated this publicly, also in writing in the Lutheran Witness, that he would like to postpone the implementation date because he thinks that especially in those districts which now have new district presidents, there will be the added opportunity then for those new district presidents to meet with those congregations that are involved in dual membership. And Dr. Preuss is also concerned, as I indicated before, about really doing justice to the problem of the missionaries overseas. Now, among the districts where there is a real problem, I would agree that there's really only one district, and that is the English district, because I believe the English district has something like 20 congregations that are at the present time holding dual membership. And I want to say in his behalf that President Bornemann, the new president of the English district, has really been pounding the pavement, so to say, trying to get something done with these congregations. He has really been very faithful in the performance of his responsibilities. The other districts, I don't see much of a problem. I think there is one other district where there are 6 congregations, and then it trickles down to each district having 2 or 1, you see. So it would seem that something could be done with that small number. But the English district would be a problem because it's pretty hard to get congregations even to agree to meet when they feel this way, when they have this anti-spirit. It's a little hard even to get to meet to them, and then it takes time to dissuade them from what they have been told and to dispute. Yes? Well, I'll tell you that. I'll give you the answer real quick. The mere fact that you know something doesn't mean that you're going to do accordingly. And that's what's happened, you see. Some of the people who do know the Constitution have been unwilling to abide by the Constitution. But I do believe that it is true, generally speaking, that most of our lay people, they are willing to trust the leadership and what they have learned to accept in their church papers and the like. But I think that very few of them have ever read the Constitution of the Synod. Okay. Fine. Secretary. Now, the problem is this, that because of the lack of proper provisions in the retirement and benefit plans, the implementation of what you have just referred to has been postponed until September 1 of this year. But the convention, and there are overtures to that effect, the convention will have an opportunity to say, as I indicated before, we don't even want to wait till September 1. We think this has all been taken care of, and we'll implement it right now on the first day of the convention. That would, of course, automatically rule out off the floor any AELC members. There is another approach which some people also are proposing, and I think it has merit, that if there is merit in postponing the implementation still further to take care of some of these problems that I referred to before, then at the same time perhaps the convention could say, but we will not allow any of these people to vote because their status has not yet been cleared up. It would be tantamount then to a suspension situation. Okay? Well, I'd like to discuss this some more, but thank you for listening.